In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
If there's one thing consistent about Marxists, or socialists and communists if you prefer, it's denial. That real Marxism hasn't been tried. Country X, Y, or Z, which used to be successful under capitalism, turned socialist and failed and went morally and financially and spiritually bankrupt. But that wasn't real socialism. For example, socialists today will tell you that despite being the National Socialist Party, the Nazis weren't really socialist because they allowed some private control of the means of production, crony capitalism. But crony capitalism is true in every socialist scheme ever. It's who you know in government. And that's because government workers don't have the skill sets to create their own company or come up with their own products or ideas. If they did, they'd be out there doing it. So they do not have the knowledge or experience to judge what is a good idea and what would have value. So without that knowledge, they instead have to rely on who knows whom and who in government would support their schemes to go forward. But they don't even care if it works or has value because it's not their money they're spending. And if it's a colossal waste of government funds, so what? Some people got employed and a few of the right people made a lot of money who donated to the right people. And by right people, I mean all leftists. But getting back to Nazis and how, despite being the National Socialists, they weren't real socialists, that also has to do with the fact that they were nationalists. They supported and loved their own country above other countries. And you can't have that in socialism because for it to ultimately succeed, socialism must eventually rule the whole world. And if there are individual countries, they would compete among each other. And we all know that in socialism, you can't have competition. One ring to rule them all, and in the darkness bind them. The last time our first guest was on, I said this, quote, "There's no better cure for socialism than actually living under socialism. I don't mean getting a taste of socialism, like with the constant welfare and Obamacare. I mean actually living under socialism, where the state uses the power of government to go after its political opponents. Where, working with socialist media, the state gets to decide who has free speech and what you're allowed to discuss. And if you disagree, you're the one spreading disinformation. Liking socialism? Just wait for full communism, which is on its way, unless voters all across the states reject socialism." End quote. Keep that in mind during today's show. I'd like to welcome James Herson back to the show. He is a former attorney and current news analyst and commentator. His best-selling book, Tales from the Left Coast, exposed the woke inside Hollywood before woke was even a thing. James, it is great to talk to you. It's been a while.
Oh, it's good to be with you, Mark. Yes, it has. An awful lot has happened to this country.
Yeah, it sure has. You know, when I said it's been a while, what that really means is it's been almost 2 years since we last talked, November of 2021. I cannot believe that it's been really that long. But when we last talked, did you really think America would be sliding downhill so quickly under Biden and that there would be Marxists everywhere you look?
No, the answer is no. I'm an eternal optimist. I of course still believe in miracles, and I believe this can be turned around, but the amazing acceleration and people's acceptance of that undermine our fundamental beliefs is quite shocking. It's happened before in history. We've seen it over and over again. And, you know, we always knew it was possible and we were always fighting against it. But it's like each and every institution in our country has been essentially invaded with an evil contagion, and it's overwhelming to say the least.
Yeah, it really is. And we're going to be talking education mainly today and zeroing in on a recent article of yours, Cultural Marxism Being Used in Teacher Hiring. But before we go there, this week at a rally in Somerville, South Carolina, Trump said that he would do away with the Department of Education and return education decisions to the states. Do you agree with that notion?
Yes, in principle, yes. There's a number of different solutions. I don't know if it's actually practically possible. I mean, a lot of people have talked about doing away with the Department of Education, but the Department of Education itself is this huge leviathan, part of a greater leviathan, which employs so many people and is, again, controlled by primarily the teachers' union and other groups on the left. And the idea of actually abolishing it may not be possible, but it may be, I hate to say this, something incremental and something we talked about before I came on, school choice, an immensely popular idea. Its time is overdue.
Yes.
And the only reason we don't have it is, in fact, the aforementioned teachers union primarily. And the Democratic Party is beholden to that group. And, you know, in their preservation of power and preservation of influence and jobs and preservation of the public school curriculum, which is a disaster and horrible, none of this is going to be easy. But school choice, the polls all say that the American people want it. Even Democrats want it. And so it's a soft spot. It's a weakness in the elite power structure. And so I see it as a wonderful start.
Yeah. I had mentioned Tales from the Left Coast. You also have weekly articles up on your website, jamesherson.com, and that's H-I-R-S-E-N, jamesherson.com. And you have another great article up there that I'd like to just briefly touch on. Will Hollywood strikes incentivize studios to accelerate AI? I didn't know this, that Hollywood is already using AIs as screeners and as script analysts. Does AI worry you, or should it worry people in Hollywood?
Oh, it worries people so much that the writer's strike is effectively over because they have no leverage simply because AI. Well, people that have messed with ChatGPT or Google's AI called Bard, there's a bunch of them out there that are open source. People can use them. They realize that AI is able to write like a human being and make it appear to be original writing. And it's just a matter of time. One of the reasons that AI is improving so rapidly is because it was designed to improve itself. So how does AI improve itself? It writes its own code. It writes new algorithms. And when I say the word algorithm, algorithm is basically a series of steps that are instructed to a computer. But when we talk about algorithms that are being used today, they're the equivalent of 50,000 pages of code.
Right.
So what's happened with these AI models is that they've gone their own path, and the original programmers have lost control of them. And that's true. Google executives have admitted that in interviews. So corporations have discovered they put together an AI project and it went off on its own. It did something different than they intended. This happened with a company called Salesforce, which the AI went off and mapped human proteins. And it was very precise, authentic. So it's very weird to talk about this because AI imitates humans. It makes you think you're interacting with a human. But in terms of the Hollywood strike, I'm a member of SAG-AFTRA years ago. I was forced to join some of the TV shows I was on. And I'm still a member. SAG-AFTRA is trying to gain leverage by adding video games to their strike.
Yeah.
But in the end, the question, you know, this idea of incentivizing them, the studios have advertised during the strike for AI professionals.
Yes.
That they're going to hire.
Yeah, I saw those, studios, and they have like astounding salaries, like up to $900,000 for that.
That's right.
That was news to me. But you know, it's not just the script writers who should be worried. Now you've got production side as well, because some of the videos and some of the artwork and even some of the songs that come out of AI, it's just astounding. You'd think that an actual human would have written all that. Okay, we are up against a break. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more with James Herzen after this. James Herzen is our guest today. He holds a master's degree in media psychology, is a New York Times bestselling author, international business attorney, news analyst, cultural commentator, and a social media scholar. And James, you have a great article up on jamesherzen.com that really caught our attention. It's called Cultural Marxism Being Used in Teacher Hiring. And we'd like to dissect that article because it was just loaded with information. And if people want to read that, head to jamesherzen.com. We'll link to it in the links and info section on today's show page, which is 13-39, and we'll link both that and some other recent articles that we enjoyed while prepping for today. So let's start by defining that term, cultural Marxism. How is that different from regular old Marxism?
Well, obviously Karl Marx essentially was an economist. I mean, he was a political philosopher, et cetera, but his field of discipline was economics, and he couched his theory in economics, economic classes, of course. And so the idea was that the inevitability of Marxism, he was influenced by Darwin. Mm-hmm. There was a sort of an economic evolution in his theory that would end up with a classless communist society. But it didn't seem to work out very well with the Russian Revolution. It didn't seem to also work out very well with most of the Western nations. So the European thinkers got together and said, well, what's wrong with this? How come we're not succeeding in spreading Marxism throughout the world? Well, they came to the conclusion it's because Marx himself wasn't too keen on influencing cultural institutions. When I say that, I mean everything from artistic to academics, to the entertainment business, pop culture, etc. And so they came up with a new concept. They used the term the Frankfurt School, because these were European thinkers. And they said, well, you know, we're going to go after, and of course, culture includes religion. So let's go after religion. Let's go after the culture, let's go after marriage, let's go after the criminal justice system. We've seen it manifest, particularly in the last few years, because we see an infiltration in all of these cultural institutions. And the idea was still the end game is communism. The end game is the unachievable egalitarianism, the classless society, which never occurs, of course. What always occurs is the old Soviet Union, today's Cuba, Venezuela, China, where you have a small group of people who act like a mafia and oppress the rest of the nation, who are all in. They do have an equality. It's an equality of misery.
Yes.
They're all miserable.
Yep.
And then, you know, and even from the point of view of classes, I mean, it's really interesting to look at China, where, yes, we believe in the principles of Karl Marx. Everybody is classless. No, we have some exceptions, though.
Yeah.
Like the Tibetans.
Yep. And that's always the way with Marxism, is that there are always, they keep trying to say, oh, well, we're all on the same level. We're all the same class. Baloney. Because it's always the leaders that end up with all of the money. And there are always a system of people that they oppress. I mean, it's clear in everything that they do. And just to continue on from that article, you say this, quote, some in the establishment media and institutional elite make the assertion that cultural Marxism doesn't even exist. I mean, you'd have to be pretty thick-headed to think cultural Marxism isn't real, but that's the level of what passes for journalism nowadays, I guess. But are they really that dull-headed? Do they refuse to see things as they are, or are they part of the disinformation campaign to let Marxism fester and grow until it's too late?
I think it's the latter. I think they're clearly, they know it exists. As a matter of fact, they, what they say, those that are promoting it say, either, you know, there's no such thing, just like they say there's no such thing as critical race theory. No, there's no such thing. So that's one approach. And then, of course, the other approach is to say, and if you look it up, do a search, look up cultural Marxism, you will see it's a conspiracy theory. Hmm. You will also see that it, the people that use that language are bigots. You know, they're either racist, anti-Semitic, or whatever. So, yes, this is, it is a disinformation campaign. And it's very interesting, and I draw a parallel, because this is ultimately spiritual.
Yes.
This is the way the evil one works. You know, in other words, there's no such thing as the devil. There's no such thing as hell. There's no such thing as the diabolical, as spiritual evil. They, this is a way to disinform people. And the reason I bring that up is because the realization of spiritual evil, that's a very important realization that ends up having people search for spiritual goodness. And when they search for spiritual goodness, they find Christ. That's what happened to C.S. Lewis, the atheist. It happened with the guy that wrote The Road Less Traveled, Scott Peck. People who were not just non-believers, but people who hated religion and hated God, all of a sudden, when they see the manifestation of spiritual evil, we see it everywhere in the world today,
yes, we sure
but some
do.
People are blind to it. It opens them up to the real ideology of good and evil, which is present in the world, and that's what the battle is right now. And that's why I think it's safe to say that Karl Marx and his teachings and all the forms of Marxism, communism, incipient socialism, these are directly from the evil one.
It is part
of the spiritual battle.
Yeah.
It poses, it's interesting, the scripture says the devil can pose as an angel of light. Isn't it amazing how these Marxists in the Soviet Union, in Cuba, they always start out so compassionate. We're going to help the downtrodden. And what happens when they get their power?
Suddenly,
the people
just
that,
like that, the switch flips, doesn't it?
That's right.
Yep. You know, it was really interesting. As I read through that article, it really reminded me of past discussions here on iSpy that we had with a former Islamic jihadist. And we often think of jihad as people blowing themselves up or military jihad and all the rest. But he was a cultural jihadist. He had come to America to destroy what he saw as a dangerous and evil society and replace it from within with Islamic ideology. So I think there's a lot of parallels there. Okay, we are up against break. Everyone stay with us. We're going to continue with James Hurston. We're talking about his article, Cultural Marxism Being Used in Teacher Hiring. You can find that at jameshurston.com or on today's show page, which is 13-39 at ispyradio.com. Stay with us. James Hurston is a New York Times bestselling author and a news and cultural commentator. You can find all of his weekly commentary articles at jameshurston.com. Hurston is H-I-R-S-E-N, jameshurston.com. And you can also find that link in today's show page, which is 13-39. And, you know, before we get back to your article, at the time you wrote your bestselling book, True Stories of Hollywood Stars and Their Outrageous Politics, did you think Hollywood would get worse and that they'd see your book as some kind of hold my beer challenge?
You know, I really did think that they would get worse, but it's similar to our previous discussion. I didn't think they'd get so bad so quickly, to the point where the Hollywood, what it used to be, was this the greatest export of America, a group of patriots that made films that reflected the values of the country, that de Tocqueville admired, saying America's great because America's good. Hollywood devolved into an evil place with evil people. I think the the biggest company and the most influential company in Hollywood is Disney. Mm-hmm. And look what has happened.
I know.
It is now shell of what it used to be. The stuff that they put out, much of it, is in fact satanic.
Yes.
And it's blatantly
Absolutely.
Satanic.
Yep.
And it's just, it's a kind of a metaphor for what's happened to Hollywood in general. It's very hard to find any product to praise other than the stuff that really isn't coming from Hollywood. It's really coming from independent Christian filmmakers. I mean, the greatest film to come out in recently is the Sound of Freedom, mm-hmm. which is made by Angel Studios, but written and directed and somewhat started by these two Mexican filmmakers, one of whom is going to run for the president of Mexico.
Yes.
That's articles, but A Sound of Freedom, we talked about spiritual evil. You want to find the ultimate spiritual evil that's going on in our world. It's in the movie The Sound of Freedom, which children being sex trafficked. It's ridiculous.
It was a shocking film, but people really do need to go see that if you haven't seen that yet. Getting back to your article about cultural Marxism being used in teacher hiring, you warned people that, quote, public school districts across the country are using a screening process for potential teachers that seems designed to ensure that future educators will be singularly aligned with cultural Marxist ideology. How can people find out if this is the hiring practice of their own particular schools?
Well, I guess they have to check and see how teachers are being hired, what kind of job postings are listed, and perhaps talk to people. There's a group called the National Opportunity Project, which is this wonderful nonprofit that I did not realize this, but they just had produced the first survey of its kind nationally, where they basically checked into just what we were talking about, job postings, hiring practices for teachers K through 12. And then they find, when I say the cultural Marxism, we're talking about all of this stuff, the gender ideology, the racial ideology that's being perpetrated by the far left, that it was being used in job postings, in interview questions of prospective teachers, in exercises they asked them to go through. It was very clear that they're screening candidates to make sure they're woke. And so they didn't want to hire teachers, not just teachers, they're not explicitly asking people, hey, are you a supporter of President Donald Trump? which that would be if you said yes, they won't hire you.
Right, right.
But they are asking people about concepts that relate to critical race theory,
yes.
to gender ideology. And it's very clear to the applicants. It's, this is easy to see
trigger
what
words.
The interviewer wants. In that sense, I suppose there are some applicants who pretend and get the job, but it's shocking to see that what is in effect cultural Marxism uses criteria to decide whether someone can teach kindergarten, whether someone can teach primary grades, all the way up to high school. And that answers a question we've had. A lot of people say, well, how in the world did our public schools get so ridiculously, extremely woke?
Yeah.
And this is a big part of the way they got in, and they're perpetuating it. It's the administrators that are in charge of recruiting teachers.
Yeah, it's the same thing that happened at the federal government level, where we had these Nazis and Marxists infiltrate that, and they just spread and hired the people that had similar viewpoints, and now we've got what we've got on the federal level. It's that same thing with education. In your article, Cultural Marxism Being Used in Teacher Hiring, you have a list of some of the hiring questions for prospective teachers, and there's this one for Virginia's Loudoun County Public Schools. They were asked, how would race and diversity impact your classroom? And the right answer should be it wouldn't. If you close your eyes, we're all the same race and we should all be treated with the same rights and same expectations as everyone else. But I'm sure I'm the wrong kind of person they'd want. So how do you suppose the right kind of candidate in their view would answer that?
Yeah, I mean, the right kind of answer is that they use the buzzwords, the right buzzwords of the woke. They say that equity will prevail in my classroom. And those children that belong to the oppressed, victimized groups will be given extra attention. And on and on. You know, in other words, the notion that we judge a person by their character rather than the color of their skin, that notion has been not just abandoned, it's been jettisoned.
Yeah, blown up.
Blown up for this new set of values that very clearly is reflected in those kinds of questions. And even uses the term, you mentioned the Virginia one. In Illinois, they're asking, well, how have you created equity in your classroom? So they're using the buzzword of equity. And you better know what equity is if you're an applicant. And the meaning of equity involves discrimination against people because of the color of their skin. That's okay. Yeah. In the woke world. Yeah,
it's absolutely crazy. I don't think Walt Disney would recognize his own company today. I don't think he'd recognize Hollywood today. I don't think Martin Luther King would recognize civil rights today. It's just shocking where we have come. James Hurson, I want to thank you so much for your time. His website one more time, James Hurson, H-I-R-S-E-N, jameshurson.com. James, thanks. And we really need to do this again sooner than 2 years.
Oh, good. Well, thanks for having me, and we will.
I'd like to welcome a brand new guest to iSpy Radio, Joe Penland Sr. You might have seen his articles lately in the Washington Examiner, Newsmax, Town Hall, or on Fox News, as he tries to alert people to the true dangers of our exploding national debt. Joe, welcome to the show. It's great to meet you.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So we want to have you on because, as I said, you are passionate about waking people up about the danger of our national debt. And it just so happens that right now Congress is once again in a fight about spending and whether or not they're going to raise the debt ceiling and all the rest. But before we get there, you're new to us and to probably most of our audience. Tell us a bit about yourself and your background. How did you get to where you are today?
Well, I'm 73 years old. I've got a large family, been blessed with that, and got a company that's been around now. We're in our 50th year. So, and we got some employees that's been with us 46, 47 years.
Wow.
A host of employees been with us in the 40s. So we're really happy about that. We're passionate about our work, and we're passionate about the community and our family, and we're very passionate about this country that gives us all the opportunity to be here. So the direction it's going now and the direction it's been going for many, many years, somebody's going to have to say something. At 73 years old, I guess I better say something this time or I may not have nothing to say next time.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit, remind people really the difference between deficit and debt. A budget deficit occurs when the money going out exceeds the money coming in for a given period. This is true not just for government, but any business. For example, in fiscal year 2022, the federal government's income was $4.9 trillion. It spent, however, $6.27 trillion, so a deficit of $1.38 trillion, or about 28% in excess of income. And that deficit was then added to the national debt, which is the accumulation of all of those budget shortfalls, and now stands at some $33 trillion, or quickly approaching roughly seven times income. And people might think, oh, that's not so bad. That's like having $100,000 income on a, you know, a yearly basis, and you own a $700,000 house to pay off. Except that's not the case, because in that situation, you'd be spending 28% above your salary before even paying anything on the debt that you owe. So earlier this year, you had launched an awareness campaign about the ballooning national debt and the need to balance America's finances here. So what's been the reaction to your efforts? Do you think people get it, or is it more of a helpless and hopeless response?
No, I think as time has went on, more and more people do understand the debt. You know, and like you said, the deficit is where you come up short every year on your budget. The debt is the accumulation of it. And, you know, it took us over 200 years to get to $1 trillion. And then when we get to Bill Clinton, when he went in office, it was $4 trillion. Now, like you mentioned, it's 33. Well, that's 8 times what it was just, 24 years ago. And somehow we've gotten on this record pace of spending money, and just doesn't matter what our budget is or what our projections are, we're going to just spend tremendous amount of money over that. And we're not getting anything back to the American people for this, except, the inflation's out of control because of our debt. We got all the problems that we have today, a lot of them that we did not have back when you look at Clinton running against Bush and Ross Perot, there was problems. We've had problems from day one. George Washington talks about, read about some of the problems he talked about when he was there. But we the problems are mounting now at a pace that we cannot keep up with. I mean, when you're going $1.5 to $2 trillion a year that you're adding that to your debt, well, there's no way to sustain that. The interest next year will be $1 trillion. I mean, that's completely ridiculous, especially when we look at the people that we owe. We owe over $7 trillion. To foreign countries, and some of those countries really don't like us that much.
No,
but they want us money because they want to make money off of us. Besides just selling us things, but over $200 billion a year is interest that goes to those countries. So you see that America is paying for a lot of things around the world that we're not getting here at home, and we're just making it, further and further and whole. Nobody, you and your wife, and any household cannot spend 8 times what you take in. There's no way. You'll lose your house, you'll lose your car, everything. But the American people have been kind of fogged into this over the years and not really paid a whole lot of attention to it, except every time when they get to fighting in Congress that we're not going to pay our bills, we're going to let the government fail and all that. And that's just a way to get more things added on to what we need just to get us out of the hole. It's unfortunate. It's really ridiculous that people have to sit here and watch this year in and year out, and there's not a choice for us to do anything except stay where we are, and that's not a good place. I mean, we're headed down a path that I promise you, in your lifetime, you and your wife's lifetime, you're going to see some things that I never dreamed would ever happen for our company.
Yeah, I think we are in for a world of hurt coming up very quickly. You have a banking background as well as a business background. Would a bank loan to a company whose debts are 7 times their yearly revenues and which runs a 28% income shortfall?
Well, Mark, absolutely not. But, the banks are regulated by the federal government, and that's the people that can't balance their budget. But if we don't write enough SARS reports, if we don't make enough loans to this sector, or we don't have enough collateral to back up this loan, they'll come in and really come down hard on the bank. And if things are too bad, they'll take your bank over. So they have all power to do just about anything they want to do, but they don't live by the same rules that they keep the bank and the American people under. It, obviously, you look at don't pay your taxes till April 16th, you and your wife, and you'll get a big penalty in interest. But the government never pays their bills. They just borrow more money and just make the hole that deeper and that wider. The banks are under a lot of pressure now to make a lot of loans, or maybe don't make loans in this sector or that sector. So we got too much government in banking.
Yeah, it really is really astounding when you think about it, that the people that can't balance their own budgets are telling everyone else how they have to do theirs. All right, we are talking about the national debt and that no one is doing anything about it. We're doing that with Joe Pendleton Sr. More after this. Joe Pendleton Sr. is the founder and chairman of Quality Mat Company, one of the oldest and largest producers of rig, oil field, and crane mats in the world. Joe has also extensive banking experience, having served on several bank boards for over 25 years, and we were talking to him about our national debt and the fact that nobody is doing anything about this. So you're not just a successful entrepreneur and businessman, but as I said, you also have a background in banking. So you can see both sides of this. When a bank takes on debt, when a business takes on debt, they are usually buying something of value, such as property or equipment that they will then use for the next 5, 10, 20 years or more, and in doing so, generate more money because of that debt. In effect, when a company incurs debt, they are buying the means to pay off that debt. That's a very different situation from what our national debt is, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, credit is a good thing for a country. I mean, if we hadn't had the ability to borrow money as a country, this country would just be a fraction of the size it is right now. You have to have the ability to borrow money to, you know, make build a house, a car loan, a furniture, kids through school, or whatever the case may be. That's good. It's good for the economy as long as you keep it under control. But our problem is the government's grown too big. It's promised too much. We subsidize too many. And we have to restructure before it's too late. Yes. There's no two ways about it. I mean, they've done a lot of things over the years to try to make people feel good. But, you know, the can has been kicked down the road to now we're at the end. Something's going to have to happen very, very soon. And we got to get some administration in there that's going to take a different look at where we are. You know, obviously, for the last 150 or 60 years, this country has had basically two choices, the right and the left, Republicans and Democrats. And back in 92, when Ross Perot did run, and he had to get out for one reason, got back in, but he got about 19% of the vote. Showed you that America really wanted a choice. But look, Mark, at where America was in 92. You owed $4 trillion. You owe $33 today. You got an open border today. You didn't have an open border then. Look at crime in the inner cities. Look at the fentanyl. Look at all the problems the country has today. And it all goes back to, if you had enough money, you could solve most of these problems. You could close the border. You could get after the crime in these cities. You could take care of the elder. You could take care of the homeless. You could do a lot of things. You could improve schools. But without money, you're not going to do any of that. So when you hear the politicians get up there and the people that want to be, that take over the big job in Washington, they talk about lots of things. But for some reason, they get off of the economy because maybe they don't understand the economy or they don't think the economy is really in trouble. Alan Greenspan didn't think it was in trouble many, many years ago. He thought, actually, we would pay it off. 10 or 11 years later, we wasn't going to pay it off.
No.
We got our debt was, we were downgraded. Our rating was downgraded. And people asked, was we going to default? He said, absolutely not. We can print all the money we want. And that's not a good answer to me and to the American people. But today, Alan Greenspan does not have that feeling today. Alan Greenspan thinks that we went way too far now. I haven't physically talked to Alan Greenspan, but I have a good friend that does talk to Alan Greenspan. So, you know, things have changed so much in the last 24 years, 12 years Republican, 12 years of Democrat, and the American people don't have a choice. So like a bad menu.
No, unfortunately we don't. You know, a news report came on the radio on Wednesday talking about Rite Aid heading towards bankruptcy due to its $3.3 billion debt. And my wife and I were talking about that. How does a company, tapping into your banking background, how does a company get $3 billion in debt and suddenly decide, well, gosh, we've got all this debt, we can't do anything? Shouldn't the first $1 billion in debt be a warning sign? And of course, the same can be said for Congress. We are $33 trillion in debt. Shouldn't that first trillion in debt have been a warning sign that something needs to change?
Absolutely. You know, and most banks, that's a rare case. Most banks don't let somebody get $3 billion or whatever the number is in debt. What happens when a bank has got a loan out here, and you never make a loan that you think is going to be bad, obviously. But when things start going bad, then you're kind of in between the rock and the hard place. You're trying to maybe keep these people afloat and see if you can help them through it. And most of the time, you get them through the bad times. Okay, you don't want to be premature and just foreclose on people and shove them out. But sometimes it gets a little more and a little more and a little more. I personally have not had any dealings with anybody that went bankrupt that owed us $1 billion.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just shocked that some companies will let themselves get that deeply into debt. Getting back to comparing the federal government to a company, if a company wanted to take on debt to pay people's salaries as a banker, I would imagine you'd say that company is in a death spiral, in a world of hurt, because, you know, I'd mentioned earlier that a business, when they take on debt, they're buying assets that will then help them pay off that debt later on. We don't have $33 trillion in value, valuable assets that I can see. So if we're effectively borrowing money to pay people's salaries, doesn't that mean that we are in a death spiral here because we're not buying things of value? This debt is solely salaries and giveaways, no assets.
Yeah, the only time that we want to loan money to people to pay payroll and expense with their own in expansion mode. You know, sometimes people take on big contracts, building a refinery or something, and they need a line of credit to fund that job. And technically, you say, well, they're borrowing money to make payroll. But, you know, right now, when you look at $33 trillion, let me tell you how much that is if you compare it to just list a bunch of countries that would encompass their whole value. You know, when you look around the people that we're doing business with, China's one of them, Japan's one of them, the countries that we do business with, that our total debt right now exceeds what their worth is. Well, that's four or five countries out there that right wow. now we owe more money than they're worth.
Wow.
And when you owe more money than four or five big industrialized countries are worth, well, then that is a tremendous amount of money. I mean, how can you get to where you're that far in debt? We're in debt three or four times those countries. That's wrong.
Yep.
And the way we've gotten that is nobody is really paying attention to how this debt is growing. It's growing because it's a silent debt. I've talked about maybe it's like a disease. It just keeps growing, it keeps growing, it keeps growing. And when it does, then it takes you over.
Yep.
$33 trillion is roughly the value of the economics of China, Japan, Germany, India, and United Kingdom together.
Wow.
Think about that, what I just said.
It's going to take some serious surgery to fix this cancer for sure. All right, everyone, stay with us. We will be wrapping up with Joe Penland Sr. He's the founder and chairman of Quality Mat Company, and we're going to be talking about how do we fix this. And welcome back. We've been talking with Joe Penland Sr. He is the founder and chairman of Quality Mat Company and also has 26 years of banking experience. We've been talking about our national debt, which he believes is the single most important issue currently facing our country. And he has been trying to wake up everyday people to this crisis. So I'd like to talk to you in this segment about what I'm sure a lot of people are wondering. We've got this $33 trillion in debt. It's about almost seven times our national income. How do we get out of this?
Well, you have to start with what I call the low-hanging fruit, which is the fraud, the waste, and the abuse that's in the government today. And we all know a lot about it. And it's not a few billion dollars. It's several trillion dollars. And a lot of very important people have called that attention. You've got to look at this. This is big things that we're doing, and we're doing it wrong. Okay, obviously, we're giving way too much money away. But the main thing is we need to look at all of our big divisions. Let's take on the military. We got to have the strongest military in the world and be the number one superpower in the world. But even with a strong military, the only way you can have that is with a strong dollar. So you always got to look back at the dollar. So, but we need to look at how much waste is on foreign bases. We got over 750 bases around the world. We need to take a look at every department that the government has. You know, we got over 22 million people working for the government today. That's as much as in the medical industry.
Mm.
That's ridiculous.
Yes.
I mean, look, we got the same amount of states, the same amount of square footage in the United States, and we have grown to that. And that's ridiculous. I mean, we got to get this click over with. And like I said earlier, you know, America's looking at a bad menu. And it's the same two things that's been on it for 160 years. We'd like to have something else because what we're getting every other time is making us sick. We cannot take this anymore. I wish we had some Republican, some Democrat brand new. Well, how are you going to get somebody brand new? They're going to come out of the crop this there. The only way you're going to get a handle on this country if somebody comes up and says, look, we got to have an independent again. In my mind, I'd love to see Ross Perot, bless his heart, if he was living today. God rest his soul. That would be something positive for this country. Somebody that's not beholden to the Democrats or the Republicans, a business person that's got his head screwed on straight for this country. These American people cannot take any more than what we're shoving down their throat today. And I don't know. We do not want to work or be owned by some other country.
No.
But if we stay on this path right here, the outlook is very dim.
Yeah, yeah.
Doesn't mean that the American people are bad. They're just as strong as they've ever been.
Yes, we're absolutely heading for disaster here if we don't do something. You mentioned fraud and abuse, and I've seen a video, too, where you mentioned theft as well, and I have to agree with you on that. How much fraud and abuse percentage-wise do you estimate as part of our spending? In other words, if we cut out all of the garbage, how much do you think that would amount to?
Well, it was right before 9/11, we had a man got up and talked in front of the Pentagon. And he said at the time, Donald Rumsfeld said that the Pentagon had 2.3 trillion in transactions that they could not track. Now, at that time, their budget was 300 billion. And you're 2.3, that's eight times. Hmm. So you got to look at those big things like that. There's a whole lot of like that. We're not watching the contracts. We're not watching the fraud. We're not watching, you know, we need to take that 87,000 people that the gentleman wanted to hire to go after me and you and the people that might have missed $800 on our taxes 5 years ago. We need to go after that fraud. We need to go after the abuse on these contracts. And we need to shut down things that we don't need. We need to streamline the government and get back to working for the American people instead of the American people working for you.
Do you think this national debt is unsolvable? I mean, have we reached the point where we just can't get out of it? Or do you think it's just a matter of actual hard work and making the hard choices?
We can get out of it. We need to make the hard choices. It's going to take a lot of that. It's not going to take a little of that. But you can't just get it by tracking down the fraud and abuse and the waste. You're going to have to make some hard choices in day-to-day America. But what the biggest thing that would help us, Mark, is more people working in this country. Because when you look at the $5 trillion that we take in, 85 or 90% of that comes off of wages.
Yeah.
And if we could get more people, 10 or 15 or 20 million more people working in this country, that would help solve our problem quicker than anything else.
Yes, it would.
And we have that many people that are unemployed. They're not seeking jobs.
Yep. Yep.
There's 100 million people of the right age that are just not working.
Yeah,
there's where we have a problem.
I think you're absolutely right. We just need more people out there working, but we also need politicians who will be out there working to do their job, to have a spine, and to make the hard choices, which means the hard cuts to spending. You can sign up for his newsletter by heading to joefromtexas.com. Joe Penland Sr., thanks for joining us today, and thanks for doing your part to wake people up to the danger we're facing here.
Thank you, Mark, and I appreciate your wife.
We all appreciate her.
Yeah, you more than me, for sure, but I do appreciate her.
That is all of our time for today. Thank you so much for joining us. You know, it's a general rule in life. Politicians only have as much spine as their constituents have. Letting politicians burn down America is like watching your neighborhood burn down and thinking somehow your house will escape the flames. How much spine do you have? I know you've got it, but are you using it? Are you holding them accountable? Don't be silent, because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.